Okay, so welcome. So tonight I'd like to explore a sutta called the Simile of the Saw. So for those who are interested, it's part of the Middle Length Discourses, number 21. So it's a very colorful sutta with lots of interesting metaphors and stories. It has a lot of depth to it also. In particular, I'd like to talk about three aspects. There's an ill will aspect that the Buddha really emphasizes, how ill will is expressed through speech. But also he compares that with metta. And I like to add emptiness as an important component of that metta. If we look at ill will, it's a very powerful way, probably the most powerful way for us to express separation, for established separation of self and other. Tying us to self and other, tying us to suffering. While metta is this deep expression of emptiness, the true metta has emptiness as its heart that comes forth and that is essential to it. So when you look at a sutta, it's helpful to look at, well, what is the Buddha talking to? Who is he addressing and why is he talking to that person? Because he didn't just give talks randomly. He was really trying to reach one particular person or a group of people to help them toward their liberation, toward their awakening. And so if you get a sense of who is this addressed to, who is the audience, can be very helpful. And to see how that audience resonates with ourselves. There's aspects of ourselves which resonate with each of these different characters that show up in the suttas. Because the Buddha always taught one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. Okay, so if you keep that as a guiding principle, and so when he talked to different people, he was always gearing that to how do I reach this particular person? How do I help direct them toward understanding suffering and the end of their suffering? And for some people, he wouldn't even talk to them. That was the best thing for them because they would be so confused with their mind and lost in thought. And other times, he'd be very engaged, really trying to connect with the person. So this sutta is more the latter. So in this sutta, the Buddha is trying to reach a monk by the name of Malia Faguna. Now, let's give you a little bit of the backstory of this character, Faguna. So his nickname was actually Malia, which is given in lay life because he used to wear his hair in a big top knot. Okay, so he walked around with this big clump of hair on top. And then it carried off when he became a monk. Of course, he shaved his head, but that kind of stuck. I think that's a nice metaphor for how much he was stuck in concept, stuck in the world of thinking and of idea. And difficult dropping into his heart. And you can see he was also known as a theorist. He was very argumentative and would debate and say, well, why are you saying it that way, Buddha? Like in one sutta about the aggregates, he kept asking, well, who feels? You know, who is the person that's feeling? Who is the one who is having this experience? And the Buddha kept saying, not a valid question. So it was interesting to see this struggle with trying to understand the teaching. And he had trouble really deepening into the practice, and eventually he left to go back to being a lay person, a household life. But this is before that. So Faguna can represent our own tendencies, our own sense of being caught in the intellectual, caught in the world of concept, and that has a reassuring quality to it, if we really are honest with ourselves. If we study the many lists of the Buddha, there's something empowering about, okay, I can name the Eightfold Path, I can name the Seven Factors of Enlightenment. And there's this way we use our intellect to hold ourselves away from really deepening into the practice, really surrendering in a very deep way. So as we go through the sutta, you know, take it in that way, that aspect that we tend to hold ourselves away from the teaching. And the sutta is really the Buddha trying to reach him and us, that aspect of us with our top knot. Okay, so there's three ways of relating to the Dharma, at least three ways. So one is we argue with it, we disagree. That doesn't apply to this situation. It's fine to be peaceful when everything is going well, but when it's noisy, when it's cold, when my life is in turmoil, then the practice doesn't hold up. Or when I'm too busy, I've got other things to do. So this is a form of arguing with the sutta, with the teaching. So as we go through the sutta, we see how Faguna tipped that sense of argument at one stage. Then there's the phase or the stage of adopting the external form. So looking, you know, faking it until you make it kind of a thing. So you have this looking nice, you know, doing the right form, but internally you haven't done the depth of transformation, the depth of practice for it to become a very internal part. And the final phase is to align ourselves internally and externally with the practice. So internally there's a deep understanding, knowing for ourselves suffering and the end of suffering, and having our external lives manifest that. So Phaguna. So this whole sutta was started because he was spending a little too much time with the nuns. Okay? He was spending a lot of time associating over too much, as the sutta says, getting too close, getting attached, really starting to grow fond of them. So and then when people would talk harsh of them, you know, say criticize the nuns or criticize him, they would start to criticize back. So it's really about this expression of ill will through speech, through the harshness, especially towards someone we care about, and how that came forth. And so another aspect of the sutta is you can see Buddha as a father figure, okay, to the Sangha. Because the Buddha's doing his thing, and then this other monk says, Buddha, better look what this guy's doing. You know, it's kind of like going to tell your dad that someone is doing wrong, the tattletale component. So this monk, certain monk, goes and tells the Buddha what Phaguna is doing. So the Buddha says, okay, tell Phaguna to come here. Tell him I said so in my name. And so he comes and sits in front of the Buddha. So the Buddha asks him, okay, you're a monk, right? You've decided to be a monk. So there's things that go along with that, including a vow of celibacy. So if you spend too much time with the nuns, that's going to tend to lead into stressing that vow. So I want you to spend less time. Don't get so attached. And he's probably also telling to the nuns at the same time with this. But the other part I want to really focus on is the part about ill will, how ill will is being expressed through this reactivity. So if anyone speaks dispraise of the bhikkhunis, which is a word for nuns, or you, I want you to train like this. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. So that was the training that he gave Phaguna, encouraged him. So really this is, what is our response in terms of the other? When someone says something especially harsh to us, that's unkind, that triggers us, what comes next? Do we react with harshness in return? Or do we work with this abiding with a mind unaffected? So there's two trainings here. One is the non-ill will, the non-expression of hatred, of anger. The other part is of metta. So ill will takes the spectrum from deep hatred to just this very subtle friction with the moment's experience. This isn't quite right, not quite the way I want it. So ill will always has this conviction of thought that we really are invested and believe in our minds, our thought, our concepts of I am right and you are wrong by default. The next time you're really upset about something, notice that quality of righteousness, of really investing in your own belief. And this actually forms the sense of other in relationship to us. We form in terms of our sense of identity, and the other person arises in response to that. So anytime that we fix someone else, fix the other, we form an opinion, an idea of someone else, then ill will can occur. That's really the background conditions. The sense of separation, of fixing, that ill will takes root. And in that place of really being righteous, listening stops. We stop really listening deeply to our partner, to our boss or employee, to a stranger. There's a sense of my way is the right way and you're wrong and you're not worth listening to. So this ill will happens when we claim identity, create a self and other. So the shades of ill will can include outright hatred coupled with action and violence, judgment, criticism, even just the quality of wanting to control ourselves and others, and just this very subtle friction with the moment. The moment's not quite right. And it's not about stopping hatred, but really what it does to our own hearts, how it affects us very deeply. The price of holding something or someone outside of our heart is really the point of this sutta. So next time you find yourself holding a grudge or you're upset about something, some interaction with someone, take a moment and release the story around it and really notice internally, what does it feel like to have this quality of ill will, to be holding on to it tightly? You know, remember, this is about ending suffering. Are you ending suffering in that moment? So the Buddha said to Phaguna to utter no evil words. So it's really, this sutta is focused primarily on speech. And I think it's important in our modern day culture to expand communication as part of that. How are we using our texting, our blogging, our Twittering? I mean, there's been such sad stories of teenagers committing suicide because of being bullied online. And you can see how this harshness seems like it doesn't have this effect, but it does. So choosing to act on it all spreads it. When I say something harsh to someone, they feel upset and they spread it to another person. It also reinforces that pattern in ourselves, deepens that groove of ill will, reinforcing separation and reinforcing suffering. But the Buddha went beyond just non-ill will. He said, abide compassionate for his welfare, for the person who's criticizing you or criticizing those you hold dear, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. So now let's talk about metta a little bit. So metta is this relationship to the world, you know, of not pushing away or of greed, but this deep friendliness. Now, if we look at the phrases that we've all been taught of may you be happy, may you be safe, these are phrases which represent metta in this tradition, but really this is a historical thing that came from a commentator, Buddhaghosa. Christina Feldman, who was here a couple weeks ago, talked about how that's really colored our understanding of metta. But if we go back to the earlier words, the earliest words of the Buddha, metta had a very different flavor. It's really that of turning toward life and being willing to sit next to life, to be close to it. It's not this sense of being in love or the sense of open-heartedness. It's actually just the willingness not to close your heart. Just the willingness to not close, but to have the possibility of being in approximation, to be close to the thing that you're upset about, that you're judging. And when metta meets pain in the world, compassion arises. When it meets success and joy, sympathetic joy arises. So metta has this very permeable way of relating to the world. Now Phaguna, remember him, he argued with this. And he said, well, that doesn't apply here. Yes, but you don't know what they said. You don't know what they said to this about this nun or what they said about me. If you knew what they said, then you would understand why I'm upset, why my anger is justified. Okay? So this is the stage of arguing with the Dharma, seeing how it doesn't apply to ourselves. This is often our own voice. My anger, my frustration is really justified here. So we can practice when it's quiet, but when there's noise, then, you know, how can I practice? And I can't practice with those who have hurt me or with my in-laws or my relatives, that, you know, my people, I have all that, there's history of pain around. What really we're saying in this case is not only is our ill will justified, but our quality of separation is justified. That I really need to have this separate sense of self. This is needed in this moment. I need to fix someone else as being other than I. So from this place, metta seems impossible. We're caught in this place of duality of that self and other. And it's important not to confuse metta with this physical proximity or feeling this loving feeling. I mean, it's not like we're going to have the same loving feeling toward our daughter as we would to Adolf Hitler. You know, it's not like, and then we try to hold that, it gets very difficult, it's very confusing of how does metta work. We get distracted by the content, what that person did, what the situation is. So metta operates underneath the content, underneath the details that we get so distracted by. It's the simple willingness not to hold anyone outside of our heart. So the Buddha's response to this sense of justification of my ill will, my anger from Phaguna, he said that even if you're struck with a knife, a hand, a clod, or in modern day we can say a gun, you should train this. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. So even though it's like, no matter what they said, even if they hit you, there's no justification for this inner will, this ill will. So it's meant to really end the argument from the Buddhist standpoint. And this is important to realize it's not about lack of boundaries or about taking care of yourself or self-protection. It's not about allowing abuse or harm to yourself and others or injustice from a society standpoint. If you imagine the last time you were sick, or that you have an injury, whether you have cancer, this is a part of your body that's caused a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of discomfort. But if we hold that outside of ourselves, we're creating the schism of our own bodies. But eventually we have to learn to bring that self, that part back into our hearts. So too with someone who's hurt us. We don't condone that person's activities, but there's a way we bring them back into our heart. We still take care of ourselves medically. We take care of ourselves in safety, take care of others' safety. That's this part about hardening and holding someone outside of our heart. This hardening of ill will. So when we look at anger, you know, and how it can be a force to change society. You look at the recent events in Egypt and how much anger is fueling that and how much damage is coming from that. How dangerous it is for everyone there. And how rare is it not to demonize the other group, the person that you're rebelling against. You know, in our own culture, we have a great model through Martin Luther King of nonviolence. You know, such deep violence and hatred was expressed toward him, toward African Americans, and still is in this modern day. And he understood what violence and anger does, that there's not the pathway to ending it. Here's a quote from him that I really appreciate, that returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding a deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. And toughness multiplies toughness in a descending spiral of destruction. So when we encounter anger, we encounter violence toward ourselves and others, metta turns into compassion. You know, we're almost at the anniversary of Sandy Hook, you know, back in December. And so when I first heard that, the news of that, there's tears that flowed for the deaths and the pain, and also the pain of the shooter, how much pain he must have been feeling. To put this out of, to how removed from his heart, to cause so much pain, to so much violence toward others. How removed from his heart he was. So, as we go back to the sutta, to help encourage Phaguna, the Buddha was recalling some good monks that needed only mindfulness aroused. So Phaguna's kind of arguing with him. He said, well, I remember this time these monks, I just said, be a little more mindful, and they just snapped to it. Why can't you be more like them? You know, can't you be more like your brother? Kind of a thing. You know, so you can see the kind of the father figure coming through. You know, all you have to do is abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states. So for many of us, and for Phaguna included, this is not overly helpful. It's a nice direction, but how do you do that? How exactly do you abide in loving kindness? How do you have a mind that's unaffected? How do you abandon what's unwholesome? So, you know, I think Phaguna was confused just as we often are. So now we come to the next phase of adopting the external form of the Dharma. How we perceive it to be what it, I think it looks like this, so I'm going to make myself look like that. Acting kind, adapting a stance of niceness without this inner support. So we just ignore the fact that we have ill will, or we repress it. And there's a subtle ownership as we're going, setting metta. May you be happy. I'm saying, may you be happy. There's this sense of me doing it to you. And the sense of repression, from when I read the suttas and I look at the tradition, this Theravadin tradition, I get the sense of repression, of a sense of denial of emotions. That, you know, don't cling, don't desire, you know, don't do anything that you like doing. Just and so there's this quality of heaviness with that. And Phaguna probably started adapting this external appearance. Okay, I'm just going to, you know, look nice and be kind of a nice, pleasant smile on my face. But I can't see that's what the Buddha meant. You know, I look inside through my own practice and the practice of others. It's not about repression. And the Buddha, in fact, went on to tell this little story here. He said, so he's talking to a group of monks and nuns as well as Phaguna. So in this very village where we're staying, there used to live a housewife. So this housewife was kind of famous for being gentle, meek, and peaceful. Everybody had this impression of her. And she also had a maid named Kali, who was clever, nimble, and neat in her work. So she was good at what she did. Now this maid thought that to test her mistress, well, you know, is she really that nice? Or is she just faking it? Is she just pretending to be nice? Is she really that gentle? Or is it she just gentle because I'm doing a good job? I don't give her any reason to be upset. So one morning she decided to get up late. And so the mistress said, "Hey, Kali, why are you up still in bed?" And she said, "Oh, no reason." So he said, "Well, you wicked girl, get out of bed and get to work." And she scowled for a while, the mistress did. So the maid thought, well, maybe since even though my mistress doesn't seem to show anger, she still feels it. Maybe I'll test her a little bit more. Okay, so the next day she got up even a little later. And again, the mistress got upset about this. And not only she expressed that, she started talking and just got more and more harsh toward the maid. So the maid's thinking, oh, you know, maybe there is something here. Maybe there is some undercurrent of anger. So maybe I'll test her one more time, see what happens. So again, she slept in. The mistress got more upset, grabbed a rolling pin and hit her on the head, cut her head. So she's bleeding. So now the maid's running through the neighborhood with blood running from her cut head, saying, "See the gentle lady's work. See the meek lady's work. See the peaceful lady's work." You know, so she's kind of broadcasting how much this person had repressed her feelings, okay, trying to adopt this quality of being meek and gentle. So the Buddha is really warning against repression in this little story, and how it can grow from repression. So you have ill will and mental, and you repress that, and it can grow into speech, and it can grow into action, as it did with this mistress. And he went on to talk about a particular monk who seemed very, very nice, overly kind, overly gentle, as long as everything was going well, as long as he had enough food and shelter and things like that. But when that didn't happen, he became more upset. So you can see that the true colors came forth in adversity. And same thing with us. When we have difficult situations, how does our practice show up? You know, when it's too cold or too loud or whatever, we're working with a difficult emotion, a difficult person, how does our practice rise up to meet that? Or are we just the fair-weather meditators? So if you look at repression versus discipline versus opening to what is. So repression denies what's really present. So there's a sound out here. Okay, so, you know, we have an inner anxiety or inner hatred, inner dislike, ill will. Do we deny that? Do we pretend it's not there? There's categories of thought that we carve out and say, this is not okay. And that's part of the spiritual makeup to have these kind of emotions and feelings. So when we do this, it creates a strong shadow that can come forth, erupt like a rolling pin, erupt like abusing altar boys. So this sense of really acknowledging what is present. You know, that's one of the things that really struck me when I got into this practice, is how it's showing this whole spectrum of the mind. You know, from lust to hatred to fear, it's all seen equally. And anything that I hide away creates this shadow. That's not that scene in gray develops into power. Now, anger can also be a very important part of grieving, the grief process. So when we grieve and we acknowledge the anger, that allows a full expression of that person's relationship with us. Because no one person is perfectly good all the time. And often we feel guilty about feeling anger towards someone who's died, that we've lost. But really bringing that, okay, I feel this anger about them leaving, about these relationships, incidents that they did, that allows the grief process to really fully complete itself, to fully come to a resolution. Anger also helps us regain wholeness from trauma, from abuse. It's this energy that's used to thaw the sense of the freeze reflex, the sense of being a victim, helps us regain our power. So the sutta is not about denying these aspects of anger, these healthy expressions of anger. It's not about denying our deep wiring of the autonomic nervous system, of the fight or flight, of the adrenal system. But can anger be felt without it becoming personal? Without it becoming personal about ourselves or about others? Without hardening into hatred? I knew a man who had a fight with his brother. So this older brother really appreciated this younger brother. And then one day, the younger brother was, they were having an argument, and he said, "You're stupid." And from that day forward, they didn't talk. There was no communication for over 30 years. Even when that man had a heart attack and died, there still was this unresolved hardening. So the original incident was so small, but it hardened into this quality of hatred that we just kept holding on to. You can see this in ethnic wars, that there's this forgotten, what was the original hurt? We just hate them because that's what my parents have done. That's what my grandparents have done. I have to carry on this tradition. So repression doesn't work. So what about discipline? So denial versus indulging in patterns. So this is what sometimes Rodney calls the know of love, the sense of drawing this line, holding the precepts, even when they're, especially when they're hard to hold. The sense of this pattern does not lead to my welfare, does not lead to anyone else's welfare. To have this sense of structure, this container that I hold my tendency to act from anger, from ill will, from greed, from hatred. How I hold that, and then I can work with it very differently. If we keep acting from these patterns, they just keep, the energy just keeps going and going. We're never quiet enough to have any kind of depth of work with it. So how we act really does matter. As long as it's done as part of this overall investigation, the sense of orientating toward the end of our suffering, the end of our distress, the sense of understanding the identification that anger and ill will holds. As long as that is part of the big component, having a sense of discipline can be very helpful. So contain ourselves. And also discipline on the other side to nurture these qualities of mindfulness, steadiness of mind, of samadhi, of loving kindness, of compassion, of joy. And these qualities of having a daily practice are very helpful with that, the discipline of sitting every day. But ultimately, the biggest discipline is the willingness to turn toward our inner pain without turning away, without blaming outside or blaming inward, but just a willingness to connect with it, to see what's the deeper story. And so this comes to this last phrase of opening to what is. Actually turning as deeply as possible to the hurt that's driving this, below the level, the normal level of ideas, of story, to that felt sense of the pain that's underneath that. Once we connect with that felt sense, that sense of embodied, okay, I really feel this in my cells, without the idea, without the abstraction, then it's much more workable in that moment. It's like if you ever had something you had to say to someone, that you were afraid they would judge you, wouldn't accept you. And when you finally said it, and they heard you, and they accepted you, recall that deep sense of relief, that deep sense of relaxing. And that, too, is what we give ourselves when we fully listen deeply to those parts that we've judged, those parts we've carved away. So in this sutta, the Buddha is really focused on speech. You know, how are we using our words, and how are we responding to words that come toward us? So he said, later on in the sutta, he talked about these five ways, courses of speech that come at us. Okay, sometimes speech is timely, and sometimes it's untimely. You know, sometimes it's a perfect time to hear it, and sometimes it's the worst possible time to hear it. Sometimes it's true, and sometimes it's false. Sometimes it's gentle, sometimes it's harsh. Connected with good or connected with harm. Spoken with a mind of loving kindness, or with a mind of inner hate. So these 10 qualities of speech, that no matter what comes at us, the Buddha suggested and asked the monks to train this way and the nuns to train this way. No matter what is said to you, train thus. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare, for the person who's criticizing me or praising me, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train. Okay, so that's a beautiful statement. But how do we do that? Okay, so here we come to the last section of how do we align ourselves with the Dharma. Okay, so the Buddha is giving this alignment, giving this model of what the awakened mind and heart act. How does it act from? How does it see the world? And we can see this is the model that he's suggesting that we connect with. So we see, where do we align with that? Are we aligned with it? Are we not aligned with it? And right in that noticing of whether we're lined up is a very important choice point. Because often if we're not lined up, we judge ourselves. You know, there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with my practice, with the teacher, with the tradition. There's something wrong with it. The other way to go is to use it as a sense of investigation, to see, okay, there's something up here I can really look and see, where am I held? Where am I restricted? Where am I identified? Because this sense of alignment given by the Buddha, from the perspective or assumption of I, what the Buddha asks looks very different. You know, it looks like repression. It looks like looking like a good, peaceful person, even if I don't feel like that. Or maybe it looks like arguing with it. How can I possibly be kind when someone is insulting me, much less hurting me? But another way to look at it is this part about abiding with loving kindness. We can look at it as a Zen koan. So a Zen koan is like a riddle that we can't solve through our normal perspective, our normal assumptions of self and other, that we have to drop below that to see a different way of relating to the world. And really that's the magic, that we get so caught up in that, we finally have to let go of our old assumptions, our old perspective of who we are in the world, to see life in a very different way. So we have to learn to see from the Buddha's eyes, to understand deeply this sense of self, the sense of emptiness. Because when we're not aligned, this is the key point. Again, as I said, the point of choice. Do we judge? Do we repress? Do we argue? Do we adopt this stance without inner work? We learn to investigate, to look deeply inside. Because that willingness to look deep inside is your spiritual practice. It's the ideal spiritual practice for each person here. It's not what the teacher says, it's where you find your own rub. It's like we're trying to give you the skills to see, where do I hold, where do I identify, where do I adopt self and other? Because each one of us we have patterns which are in common, but also very unique manifestations of that. That it's really our spiritual task to understand that, to understand it very deeply. To understand what has to be given up to see from the eyes of the Buddha, to abide with a mind unaffected, with compassion and metta. So the Buddha does give us some good clues. This is my favorite part of the sutta, when he really gives some beautiful metaphors of how the awakened heart acts in relationship to ill will. This is where ill will meets emptiness, and metta emerges from that emptiness. And there's no place for personalization to land, no place for it to stick and take hold. So remember, ill will is one of the strongest ways we can create the sense of self. You know, hating, we really are established in ourselves. We really are established in the other. So all these metaphors start with a person intent on ill will and harmful action. So the Buddha said, imagine that a man came with a hoe, you know, with a shovel. I shall make this great earth to be without earth. Okay, I'm going to get rid of the earth. I'm going to dig through the dirt and spread it. I'm going to put it here. Be without earth. Be without earth. So he's trying to get rid of the ground. Okay, when you think about the immensity of the earth, how ridiculous that seems. And so the Buddha asked the monks and nuns, could that man make the great earth be without earth? No. And why not? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. And now he says, be like that. Make your mind like that immeasurable sense. So as you're listening, see, how does that feel to have sense of immensity? That a little insult to someone trying to move a piece of you here or there makes absolutely no difference to the earth. And from that place, then pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind similar to the earth, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And then now comes a man with paint. I shall draw pictures on the sky, on the air. I shall make pictures appear in empty space. Okay, so he's trying to paint the thing. So there's a delusion with that. And so the Buddha asks, will that work? And no, because empty space is formless and non-manifest. And so be like that. Be like this empty space, that there's nothing that people can... ill will can come toward you, but there's nothing that sticks. So all these keep pointing back to this heart of emptiness. This is the abiding with the mind unaffected. And from that place naturally comes forth, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind similar to empty space, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. And next comes a man with a blazing grass torch. And he's going to go to the river Ganges and say, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges. Okay, so is that going to work? No. Why not? Because the river is deep and immense. So this quality of this fire comes toward us that we're so vast that it has no effect. It just extinguishes instantly. So again, have your mind be like that. Be like that river, that nothing can light on fire. And so here's the final one, that a man comes with a stick to a catskin bag. So which was soft and silky, really well rubbed, so it was very, you know, very easy, pliable, very pliable. And I shall make this catskin bag rustle and crackle with the stick. Okay, so it's, you know, no matter how hard he hit it, how much he shaked it, it's too smooth to make any kind of sound. And so make your mind pliable and soft like this catskin bag, no matter what kind of speech comes toward you. So from these four metaphors, you can, especially if you take them all as a practice, a sense of, how does the sense of the earth feel, the sense of immensity? How does this spaciousness, this non-forming of empty space, the depth of the river Ganges, that can, no fire can light on fire, no fire can dry out, the sense of pliability of the bag that can't make any sound. As we hold that, the Buddha is really pointing toward this true metta comes from emptiness, outside of notions of self and other. It's really the natural expression of the awakened heart. So as I read these four metaphors, I get this sense of a vast stillness that settled over the audience, this deep quiet, as people open to this sense of emptiness, this sense of deep stillness. And at this point, I imagine our friend Faguna raising his hand. Okay, I'll be just like that. I can do that. I'll adopt that philosophy of emptiness. I'll become someone who is empty. But what is if someone says my mother wears army boots? You know, insults me again. You know, so he's still holding on to that. So then the Buddha comes to his final attempt. He didn't really say the army boots. I'm editing and making it a little more interesting. Then the Buddha's final attempt to reach Faguna. And this is really the namesake of this sutta. So Faguna, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. So the Buddha is just saying, you know, enough of these excuses. It's ill will harms yourself, harms everyone else. So the Buddha then ends, keeping the simile of the saw in mind, is there any course of speech, trivial or gross, that cannot endure, that you cannot endure? You know, so keeping the sense of, if I was being sawed. Now, as you hold that metaphor, it's very grisly and very horrific. But where can the sense of self hold on to that? Okay, we can have the sense of adopting this place. Oh, can I be loving and kind? But can I my mind hold that being sawn aside? It sort of asks us to really deeply relinquish this identification with self, this sense of separation as being true, of being other. And that's really the point of this, of the sutta, not practicing being sawn and not wishing well. We cannot continue claiming I. So this becomes the final riddle. How does what mind sees from that? Until we fully release identification with self and let metta naturally flow. And just to conclude, Nisargadatta said it like this. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life flows. Let's just sit quietly for a few moments. Okay. So now we have some space for a discussion. If people have questions or comments, both about this talk or this subject, but also other areas in your life or your practice, I'll be welcome to see if I can address them. Yes, Suze. You're welcome. Yes.
And the mind will make all kinds of excuses, like I'll just die with it or top knot. But when I really feel what's happening in my body and the kind of the unpleasantness and the constriction and the pain,
yes,
it gives me a good clue that maybe I shouldn't believe in believing. So I was wondering if you could just talk more about
it. Sure. So the comment was about when ill will is in her experience, that going into the world of thinking, it's hard to resolve it. But when she connects with the body sense of it, then there's a very different way of relating to it. Is that? And that's an excellent way to approach it. Because in the world of thought, can we ever resolve it? You know, can we really, have you ever, I mean, I'm sure you've tried to resolve ill will through thinking, through emotion, right? Having those endless conversations, oh, if he says this, I'm going to say that, and you know, you just go back and forth, and you just, you know, I've spent hours and hours caught in that, and it doesn't ever seem to resolve. But as Suze was saying, that if you connect with the body, then automatically we're connecting with something that's in the moment, really directly in the moment. There's a way of relating to it beyond or below. It's really like we're dropping below, it's like the level, like a low level fog, we're cutting below that to see the underlying reality of the body, the felt sense of this emotion, of this ill will. And that's such a great refuge for us, and especially in this culture that we have such a faguna tendency with our top knot of thought to come into our bodies as a place of feeling things very deeply. You know, if you look at the four foundations of mindfulness, the biggest section is on awareness of the body. You know, feeling the sensations of the body, feeling the breath, having this as a very grounded orientation. In the beginning class, we always begin with awareness of breath and body. Because without that stable point, we become so lost in thought, so lost in ideas. And when we connect with that, when we connect with the deep sense, I think it's important to also bring in an ear for the underlying kind of quiet belief structure, the quiet voices of identification or tendencies of identification that we can have access to. So up here, and she said this, and I said that, it's very hard to access that. When we come into our body sense and quiet with that and be very still with it, this requires a willingness to hold physical discomfort, emotional discomfort without moving into thought, but to be very still with it. Often we start to see this perspective of how we hold ourselves to be, kind of the underlying logic of it, if you will, that I'm inadequate, there's something wrong with me, for example. And then we touch into that pain, we go into even deeper in a felt sense of that. So this is a very nice way to deepen into our practice in daily life, and it's really the perfect daily life practice. Thank you. Yes, Joyce. Yes.
You know, ordinarily, the practice of loving kindness seems to come from the heart, which is maybe more from an eye perspective.
Yes.
Can you talk about the distinction?
So the question is about the difference between metta coming from the heart, the sense of I'm, you know, sending this metta versus coming from emptiness. So I don't want to criticize the practice of sending metta as it's traditionally been taught, the sense of may you be happy, because it can be very helpful to counteract these deep patterns of self-hatred, dislike, of fear, of anger. It's an incredibly important antidote, and it's also a concentration practice. So it's a way of basically you're giving the mind something to do, instead of saying, I'm such a stupid person, I hate this, I hate that. It's like, Okay, may you be happy. It's a very different voice to start to nurture and to build forth. And there's a few years ago, I was driving someplace, and I parked, and I just had, it was, as I often feel, this, you know, following this train of self-identification, and got down to this sense of deep inadequacy or deep something wrong with me. And the next voice was, and that's not true. You know, that was a wrong belief. That was a mistake that I made. It's not in a judgmental way, but that was a wrong assumption. And metta is the power of doing that. So it has a very incredible depth of potentiality. And we also have to bring into context that metta is not something that we ultimately do. It said that all the Brahma Viharas are the natural expression of the awakened heart, the awakened mind, that naturally it sees the world with compassion, with loving kindness, with sympathetic joy, and with equanimity. These are just the natural expressions of the awakened heart. So sometimes experiment with that, being very still and seeing when I drop all sense of separation, when I drop all sense of self and other, how does metta flow? Allow that to flow, that interaction with the world. You know, as Nisargadatta said, you know, when I see I am empty inside, that's wisdom. When I see I am everything, that's love. And between these two, my life turns. And so this perspective that it's this deep, it's like when we're, it's the natural expression of the awakened heart is this loving kindness. And as Christina was talking about, this quality of sitting next to, being close to, can be very helpful. Because we can think of metta as being looking a certain way or feeling a certain way. I have to feel this lovey feeling or this affection feeling, and you know, you throw out Adolf Hitler, and where does that go? But if you connect with the inner pain and just the willingness to be next to, the willingness that we're all, there's some part of us which is all the same. There's this deep interconnection. So you're connecting with that. And that is really through emptiness, through stillness. And so it's emptiness is kind of a funny word, because it's really the opposite of emptiness. It's so full and so rich that nothing is held outside of that. And so, you know, emptiness, you know, came from the Zen tradition of seeing that releasing of identification is what emptiness stands forth. But the experience of it is it's an incredible richness, incredible intimacy with life. And that relationship to life is naturally that of metta, of kindness, well-wishing. You're welcome. Yes.
So, you know, if I have this straight.
Okay.
You're saying that emptiness is the absence of identification.
Yes. So, so we're going to hear that emptiness is the. Say it again. It was such a quick question. I wasn't fully dialed in. Emptiness is the absence of identification. Yes, so we can see that identification, separation, claiming I, me, and mine, self and other, those are all ways that we really establish our world through thinking, through concept, you know, through memory, through our emotions. And as we see through that, as we release that, emptiness is what's there. So you can say emptiness is really the backdrop that holds everything. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't negate that we have emotions, that we have thoughts, we have a sense of identity, but just how stable is that? How permanent is that? Is it never changing, or is it based on what conditions have come forth to form who we take ourselves to be, moment after moment? And there's a process, there's a deep stillness of emptiness underneath that. You know, really the realization that is an always changing process. Then inherently there's not a solid sense of self. There's nothing that we can identify with and a long-lasting success with that. You're welcome. Yes. So the question is emptiness the same as a sense of boundarylessness, the lack of boundaries? Okay. So in talking about emptiness and boundaryless, you know, it's from a standpoint of the intellect or the thinking about it, it can get a little tricky in there. Boundarylessness, you know, boundaries are really how we establish the sense of protection, of sense of self, and that's really a big utility of the sense of self. Okay, I know that I need to do this distance to be safe from this tiger, from this person. I know how to do my job so I can have money. So those are all healthy forms of boundary. The problem is when boundaries become something that we invest in as being absolutely true, that we never let go of those boundaries. So it's in some ways you have the ability to have boundaries when they're needed, but also you realize that this is something that you're imposing upon the moment versus something that is always how you see life from. So boundarylessness can be an expression of that emptiness. But also the sense of form can be that. Having boundaries can be part of the emptiness. See, emptiness holds both aspects, both the formed, both the sense of boundaries, and also the release of boundaries, the release of separation. While, you know, the sense of self just holds one aspect, just holds the separation, just holds the restriction. So it's like this deeper thing that holds both, and, you know, as what's appropriate in this moment. So one's ultimately not better than the other. We often get the sense that emptiness and non-self is preferable to self. And really, that's just a stage that we go through. That once we see that, really, any preference itself is just more selfing, more sense of thought and identification. And so we have this equalness that all thoughts are equally valid. You know, boundaries or not boundaries are equally valid. Now, saying that, we can throw up lots of real-life situations. So when it's necessary to have boundaries, have boundaries. Keep yourself safe. Keep other people safe. But just how much do we hold that as being our reality? All right, any other questions or comments or anything at all is perfectly fine. Yes. 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 So the comment, yes. Yes, so the comment was about the appreciation for those metaphors from the sutta of just the immensity, the depth of equanimity, that this little insults have no place of taking hold. And he's trying to describe emptiness in the most direct way he can, you know, through the language of metaphor, through the language of image, that we can how would I be like that? And we really go into that. How would it be to have my mind like the earth or like air? And there's a part of you that will drop away. Yes. Thank you, Lindell. All right. Any last questions? All right. Do we have any announcements?